ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, welcome to The World Today. It's Monday, the 27th of April. I'm Andy Park, coming to you from Gadigal Land in Sydney. Today, the desperate search for five-year-old Sharon, abducted from her home where a man recently released from prison was staying. And how do you learn the ropes in one of the hardest jobs there is? One program helps farmers make tough, make-or-break decisions in life on the land.
So you can sit in a university lecture, as I did for 10 years, and you can get all the science and all the information, but unless you can put that into something practical, it really means nothing. And that's where Lifetime U, I think, has been really successful.
Donald Trump has defended his security team who stopped an armed gunman who opened fire near a checkpoint at the White House Correspondents' Dinner on Saturday. The suspect's manifesto refers to weak security on site before the incident, in which US President Donald Trump and his senior staff had to be evacuated. 31-year-old Californian man Cole Thomas Allen has been arrested on the scene. Here's Bridget Fitzgerald.
Under a bright blue California sky, FBI agents approach a house connected to the alleged shooter, Cole Thomas Allen. They're followed closely by members of the press.
Any comments, agents? What you guys are up to?
The 31-year-old man from Torrance, a city outside Los Angeles, has been described as a highly educated tutor and amateur video game developer. As law enforcement continue their investigation, Allen's targeting of the White House Correspondents' Dinner appears to be politically motivated. He reportedly sent what's been described as a manifesto to family members in the minutes before the attack, railing against the Trump administration. In a fiery exchange with journalist Nora O'Donnell on CBS News after the shooting, US President Donald Trump criticized media outlets for broadcasting the contents of Allen's writings.
I got associated with all stuff that has nothing to do with me. I was totally exonerated. Your friends on the other side of the plate are the ones that were involved with, let's say, Epstein or other things. But I said to myself, you know, I'll do this interview and they'll probably, I read the manifesto, you know, he's a sick person, but you should be ashamed of yourself reading that because I'm not any of those things.
Mr. President,
and I was never,
excuse me.
You shouldn't be reading that on 60 Minutes. You're a disgrace. But go ahead, let's finish the interview.
Cole Thomas Allen is accused of rushing at a security checkpoint with weapons and firing a gun at the Washington Hilton, where more than 2,000 journalists and government officials were gathered for the Correspondents' Dinner event. President Trump and First Lady Melania Trump were surrounded by Secret Service agents after shots could be heard outside the ballroom. The president described the moment to CBS.
When I was walking out, it was pretty about halfway there, and they said, please go down to the floor, please go down to the floor. So I dropped to the floor, so did the First Lady.
What was your thought at that moment? What did the First Lady say?
Well, my thought was, you know, I've been through this before a couple of times, and she has not, to this extent, she handled it great. I mean, she's very strong.
This latest incident comes after multiple assassination attempts on President Trump. Javed Ali is an expert in national security law at the University of Michigan and a former counterterrorism official with the FBI.
In at least the manifesto or parts that I read, it seemed that there were much deeper grievances beyond the singular focus on President Trump. So not only was it President Trump, but it was a whole host of policy issues carried out by the administration.
Javed Ali says it appears the suspect didn't give any indication of what he was planning until just before the attack, which makes it difficult to prevent. But he says there will now likely be an investigation into whether any red flags were missed.
I doubt there's realistically or practically anything that could have been done to find him because nobody knew where he was. I don't think he gave away his location either, despite sort of the ideological basis for the attack.
Some commentators and witnesses to the event have questioned the adequacy of security. Robert McDonald is an assistant professor of practice at the University of New Haven and a retired supervisory special agent with the US Secret Service. He says the team did a good job, but that the incident will be reviewed.
I'm guessing he walked right through the front lobby, which was not secured for this event. I'm sure the Secret Service with its other partners are going to be looking into exactly what happened here, and more importantly, how did it happen?
Paul Ekloff is another former special agent with the United States Secret Service. He says the incident highlights a broader problem of political violence and extremism.
And while he may have acted alone, people are rarely radicalized alone. He didn't emerge in a vacuum. There's often a digital trail of reinforcement, encouragement, and escalation. And these online ecosystems can act as accelerants. When you surround someone with constant validation of extreme views, you're not observing risk, you're creating it. And that's what we're seeing. We're seeing that played out on the world stage. And in this case, at the most media attended event in the world.
One agent was injured during the incident when he was shot in his bulletproof vest. He's since been released from hospital.
Bridget Fitzgerald there, who has the investigation into the security incident at the White House Correspondents' Dinner unfolds. Donald Trump has used the event to demand an end to objections to his pet project, the new White House ballroom on national security grounds.
I didn't want to say this, but this is why we have to have all of the attributes of what we're planning at the White House. It's actually a larger room, and it's much more secure. It's drone-proof, it's bulletproof glass. We need the ballroom. That's why Secret Service, that's why the military are demanding it.
The $400 million project has been dogged by controversy and lawsuits. Our reporter Barbara Miller joined me earlier. Barbara, what has been so controversial about this ballroom project?
Well, opponents of the ballroom think it's too big. It dwarfs the existing White House structure, both in terms of its square meterage and its height. It's badly designed, they say. There's a grand staircase, for example, that leads to nowhere. And it's simply too rushed. That's not the way you do things in the US Capitol. If you're going to make changes to buildings of major significance, they are months, years in the planning. Now, Donald Trump only has 2 more years in office, so it is a little bit rushed. He wants this done by 2028. And there's been this legal stoush ongoing with the National Trust for Historic Preservation. Now, one of the women in that lawsuit, a board member, Alison Hoagland, has argued that it interferes the construction of this huge ballroom with her aesthetic pleasure, essentially, when she's walking around DC. So Donald Trump, in a post urging opposition to the ballroom to be dropped, mockingly referred to it as a ridiculous lawsuit brought by a woman walking her dog. And he's also got his acting attorney general, Todd Blanche, in the wake of the incident at the White House Correspondents' Association dinner, pressing this trust to now abandon its legal challenge.
It's nice to know we have NIMBY neighbours across in the United States like we do here in Australia. Do we know who's paying for this ballroom? Because that's been part of the story, really, hasn't it?
Well, Donald Trump has given a long list of major companies who he says are donating some money. They include Amazon, Google, Meta. He's also given a list of billionaires who he says are also donating money. And reportedly, the president himself is paying a portion of the costs. Now, that list has raised concerns about what that money buys you. Does it buy you access? Essentially, you're paying for a piece of the White House. And of course, like many renovation projects, the costs seem to be blowing out a little. Donald Trump initially talked about it costing $200 million US. It's now the talk is of about $400 million US, and that is about $560 million Australian.
You've worked in the White House. It's actually quite a small place, really, when you think about it. And obviously, there are the national security implications for the work that goes on in the White House. What are the dimensions of this ballroom when it comes to national security?
Yes, it's very small and very white. Those are the two things that strike you about the White House. But what this whole furore has done is lifted the lid on what's been an open secret in Washington, and that's what happens underneath the White House. And there is some kind of operations center there, a presidential emergency operations center. It's featured in some films, for example, the recent House of Dynamite. And it was used in the wake of 9/11, Laura Bush, the president's wife, and Dick Cheney, the VP, were rushed down there. And Donald Trump is suggesting that there are upgrades essentially going on to this underground bunker in some way, and that this whole plan for the ballroom is in conjunction with the military. And he's told reporters that the ballroom construction essentially should work as some kind of shed for what's going on underground. So this incident at the dinner, I think it strengthens his argument for the ballroom in two ways, potentially. One, because it would provide, in his argument, a safer location for a dinner like that. Two, if there really are major upgrades going on to the facilities underneath the White House, then a potential attempt on the president's life would surely only increase the urgency that those works are completed. Right now, the next hearing in terms of the legal challenge is scheduled for early June.
Barbara Miller. I'm Andy Park. Thanks for listening to The World Today on ABC Radio across Australia and on ABC Listen. You can subscribe to our podcast for all of our stories. Just search for The World Today. To Alice Springs now, and the police have said they believe a five-year-old child, a girl, who went missing from an Aboriginal town camp early on Sunday morning may have been abducted. Officers have said this morning that they are searching for a 47-year-old man who was recently released from prison and was seen in the vicinity of the girl's home. Our Northern Territory reporter Jane Barden joined me earlier.
The police have said that her mum put her to bed at 11:30pm on Saturday night and then checked on her again at 1:30 in the morning on Sunday and saw that she wasn't there and rung police immediately. And the police have said they're looking for the little five-year-old called Sharon. They're not releasing her second name publicly at this stage. And officers are saying that they believe that she may have been abducted.
And what have the police said today about the man that they're looking for?
The police have said that they're looking for a man, Jefferson Lewis, aged 47, who is a recently released prisoner, and he had basically been in prison for offences including physical assaults and domestic violence, no child-related offences. They don't believe he's directly related to Sharon, but that he was seen in and around her house on Saturday afternoon and is believed to be known to her mum and her family. And this is what Acting Commander Mark Gree from NT Police said about believing that Sharon may be with this man.
Look, it's suspected at this point in time. We think he can provide information. Certainly, he's the only person that who we haven't been able to locate and speak to, who was in and around that area at the time. Considering himself and Sharon went missing at around about the same time, it certainly brings about those suspicious circumstances, and we'd like to speak to him about that.
That's Acting Commander for the NT Police, Mark Grieve, there. So how do the police say the girl's family has reacted to this?
Well, the NT Police have said that the girl's family are just beside themselves and appealing to anybody who has any information to give that to the police. There's been a massive search involving some family, friends, but also ATVs, horses, dogs, drones. And Acting Commander Mark Grieve said this is basically the situation for the family at the moment.
It's a terrible, you know, situation to have such a young child go missing. We're just, you know, we're over 24 hours now. So it'd certainly be my worst nightmare as a parent. We're wrapping around the mother. We've actually facilitated some other accommodation just to provide her with some extra support and her family members.
That's Acting Commander Mark Grieve from the NT Police. Before him, our reporter in Darwin, Jane Barden. Anzac Day services around the country over the weekend were marred with boos directed at senior Indigenous veterans whilst they were delivering a welcome to country. While condemning the heckles, opposition leader Angus Taylor also voiced his concern that the welcome to country is overused and becoming devalued. The Returned and Services League of Australia says the booing was grossly disrespectful, and one senior Indigenous leader has called for authorities to step in at future events. Here's Kimberly Price.
Silence fell among the 11,000 gathered at the Cenotaph in Martin Place in Sydney's CBD on Anzac Day. Cubby Cubby and Gurung Gurung man, Pastor Ray Minicon, stepped up to deliver the acknowledgement to country for the service.
We gather today on land that is sacred. For thousands of years, people have gathered in this place to share stories, to celebrate culture, and to remember our ancestors.
For more than a minute, Uncle Ray persisted through the booing. The ex-serviceman greeted with applause as he finished.
And may we remember the sacrifices that made it possible in that tradition on this land. We will remember them.
One heckler was arrested. But the incident in Sydney wasn't an isolated one, with similar boos heard at the Indigenous welcome at services in Melbourne and Perth. Senior military figures and politicians, including the premiers of all three states, fiercely condemned the disruptions. Opposition leader Angus Taylor labelled the acts as un-Australian in an appearance on ABC Insiders on Sunday, but he also suggested welcome to countries are overdone.
I think they are devalued by overuse. I would like to see them used less, and therefore not devalued as I think they have been over time.
Mr. Taylor's opinion is similar to that of former opposition leader Peter Dutton, who shared his belief last year that Anzac Day services should not involve welcome to country ceremonies. Chief of Joint Operations Command for the Australian Defence Force, Vice Admiral Justin Jones, told Sky News that he believes the heckling is a democratic right.
Well, one of the things that we in the Defence Force are defending, as I've said, is our democracy and freedom of expression. So whilst that might be disappointing, those are exactly the principles that the Australian Defence Force is designed to defend.
The principle of freedom of speech it can be exercised by all of us.
Richard Marles is the Deputy Prime Minister and the Minister for Defence.
And let me say, I'm exercising my freedom of speech right now to make it absolutely clear that the booing that occurred on Anzac Day was a disgrace. And that's the only way in which it ought to be characterised.
Marcia Langton is a Yiman and Bidjaral woman and a Professor of Australian Indigenous Studies at the University of Melbourne. She believes the hecklers don't understand the meaning of a welcome to country.
They think it's welcome to Australia. It's not. It's welcome to the country of the original people where the Anzac ceremony is being held. And the forces of the right have perverted the meaning of the welcome to country ceremony and turned it into a very ugly nonsense.
Marcia Langton says at future events, people who boo should be barred.
I think there should be a greater police presence to protect those who observe Anzac Day.
Veterans organisation RSL Australia has strongly condemned the booing.
Kimberly Price reporting there. Australians with ties to former Islamic State fighters are once again attempting to return to Australia after years in a Syrian refugee camp. It comes months after a previous attempt, which sparked a broader political debate here at home. Tanya Dendrinos has more.
Four women and nine children with links to former ISIS fighters left Syria's Al-Roj refugee camp on Friday for the Syrian capital, Damascus. From there, they'll attempt to travel home to Australia. Richard Marles is the Deputy Prime Minister and Minister for Defence.
The government is not involved in the repatriation of these people. We're not providing any assistance for these people to come back to Australia.
The government has said the cohort should be aware that if they have committed a crime and if they return to Australia, they will be met with the full force of the law.
Our intelligence agencies, and we very much support the way in which our intelligence agencies operate, and we have complete faith and confidence in them, monitor the situation in respect of everyone who is coming into the country and where there are security concerns.
It comes months after a group of 11 women and 23 children attempted to return to Australia but were forced to return to the refugee camp. It sparked a political furor. Home Affairs Minister Tony Burke said Australia was under a legal obligation to provide the group with passports given they are citizens, but the government remained adamant it would not assist in their repatriation. Prime Minister Anthony Albanese going as far as saying he had no sympathy for the group. The government also issued a temporary exclusion order for one of those citizens, meaning they could be banned from entering Australia for up to 2 years. Speaking on Sky, the Deputy Leader of the Liberal Party, Jane Hume, said she believes the group will make it back to Australia.
These are people that we know have actively left Australia and gone to join ISIS-linked terrorists overseas to fight against everything that Australians believe in: equality, the rule of law, democracy. Now, the government has the power to stop them. It has temporary exclusion orders. It has the ability to cancel passports, but it's chosen not to do this.
Senator Hume says the government has lacked transparency over the issue.
We want to understand exactly what advice has been given to the government and what the government is going to do when these people return, because they haven't used the powers that they have to stop them. So if they are going to return, well, what happens next?
She did, however, express sympathy for the minors who are part of the group.
These poor children who are suffering from the sins of their parents, are in a terribly, invidious position. However, we're not in the business of splitting up families.
Sure.
Michael Shoebridge is the Director of Strategic Analysis Australia. He argues the presumption of innocence, a core international human right that Australia is party to, isn't being afforded to the women seeking to return.
We're all acting as if they're guilty before any legal processes happen. So I think the right moral position here is to recognise we've got an obligation to our Australian citizens. That obligation extends to people we don't like, including women if they've worked with a terrorist organisation. But our primary responsibility is to bring our citizens home.
The government has said that it won't play any role in repatriating these families. Do you think it needs to go further than that?
The government is being morally bankrupt here. They don't have the political or moral courage to lead the country through a difficult issue. Yes, it's confronting to bring what we call ISIS wives back to Australia, but it's the right thing to do. The Prime Minister should be able to look everybody in the eye and say, I am bringing our citizens home. Those who've committed crimes will be prosecuted, and the children and everyone else will be supported to reintegrate back into our successful society.
That's Michael Shoebridge from Strategic Analysis Australia, ending that report by Tanya Dendrinos. If you're a farmer, I don't need to tell you this, but life on a farm is never easy, especially now with high diesel prices and ever more extreme weather events. So where do you learn how to ride out the bad times and keep the nation supplied with food or fibre? One sheep farming course has been doing just that for 20 years now. Farmers are calling it a game changer, helping them make good decisions in tough times. Here's Ted O'Connor.
On a property near Balmoral in Victoria's West, Diana Tate feels a sheep's spine under its wool to see if the muscle is dipping, flat or bulging. This is called condition scoring. Her trainer, Steve Cotton, wants her to be quick and accurate.
Say 3.25?
Yeah, because I can still feel the end of those short ribs.
Diana's a sheep farmer from Dunrobin. She's among a number of primary producers from her area who are learning this technique so they can tell if their sheep have been getting too much or not enough feed. Later, Steve Cotton uses shears to cut a small section of dry pasture to weigh and estimate the amount of feed in the paddock.
We need to understand how much energy the sheep are extracting.
More than 5,000 farmers have done the Lifetime Ewe Management course across the country. One of its students, Diana Tate, farms in a part of Victoria that's been hit hard by a recent record-breaking drought.
The courses show me that when you're looking at the cost of keeping sheep in a good, healthy condition, it's better off to maintain their weight than let them slip away, because you're only going to have to pour more food and money down their throat. The aim of farming, I guess, is to make money, and if you're not making the right decisions, you're not going to be making a profit.
So what's driving
life as a primary producer is never easy, but extreme weather and skyrocketing diesel prices have made it especially hard recently. Farming consultant Steve Cotton says the course turns years of scientific research into a system any farmer can pick up.
So you can sit in a university lecture, as I did for 10 years, and you can get all the science and all the information. But unless you can put that into something practical, really means nothing. And that's where Lifetime Ewe, I think, has been really successful.
The course has been going for 2 decades. It's run by Australian Wool Innovation and Rural Industry Skill Training Centre, an agricultural college based near the renowned sheep farming hub of Hamilton in southwest Victoria. RIST says farmers who've completed the course have boosted both lambing rates and the number of sheep their farm can support by about 10%. Its CEO, Bill Hamill, says the course's tools are more reliable than traditional methods of assessing pasture and sheep health.
What the past practices were, you'd drive through the paddock, you'd look at your ewes in the paddock, but it wasn't a measure to manage philosophy back 20 years ago. So that was the big change. with very strict controls on the condition scoring of the ewe and also monitoring the amount of pasture that ewe needs to eat to actually stay in that condition score.
Down the road, Scott Mullins' sheep guzzle grain from an automatic feeder.
It is an obsession. We love knowing what they need and then matching that with what we can give them.
The latest research is analysed and will soon feed into the program. For Diana Tate, making good day-to-day decisions sets up her long-term goals that stretch well beyond her life on the farm.
I've got two little young kids at home that are 8 and 5 and feel like whatever changes we can make now is only going to benefit them down the track.
Dunrobin sheep farmer Diana Tate ending that report by Ted O'Connor. And that's all from The World Today, team. Thanks for your company. I'm Andy Park.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. It was a video that went viral and left viewers outraged. In it, it's revealed the government receives more money from a tax on beer than from the tax on the profits of massive oil and gas projects. Today, the ABC's chief digital political correspondent, Claire Armstrong, on the growing campaign for a new gas tax. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on ABC Listen.